The following message is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U from the Chapel of Reformed Theological Seminary's Orlando campus, a graduate theological school committed to the authority of God's Word, where students develop a mind for truth and a heart for God. This message from our October 29th, 2014 chapel service comes from Kevin Twitt, founder of Indelible Grace Music. It is entitled The New Hymns Movement. If you would like to know more about RTS Orlando, we invite you to visit our campus webpage at www.rts.edu/Orlando. And now, Kevin Twitt.
So it really is a pleasure to be with you all this morning. It's actually my second time to get to preach at chapel here at RTS. And it's good to be back. I'm trying to move out of the way of the sun. It's bright down here. It's nice. Nashville was just getting really cold when I was leaving, so I'm glad to be down here at least for a little bit. So I wanted to talk just briefly about these hymns and this retuned hymn movement. Maybe some of you have heard of this, maybe you haven't. You know, really the idea of retuning hymns is not, it's not a brand new idea by any means. If you look at most hymnals, the date of the text and the date of the tunes are often different. Sometimes texts are written to tunes that already exist. Sometimes tunes are written to texts that already exist. Lots of examples of that. But around the beginning of the 20th century, it seems that kind of people kind of get locked into this tune goes with this hymn, this tune goes with this hymn. People all the time will say, you know, well, what was the original tune to that hymn, which is often not even a question you can answer. You know, Amazing Grace has been done to many different tunes. Even today in England, the tune they tend to sing it to is different than the tune that we tend to sing it to here in America. And so, you know, there's no rule about it. But in our case, it really came out of two things. For one thing, in RUF, which is the campus ministry of the PCA, Reformed University Fellowship, maybe some of y'all are familiar with that, I was teaching a Sunday school class at Christ Community Church where Scotty Smith was the pastor back in the late 80s in Nashville, and the first RUF group in Tennessee started at Vanderbilt University, and I had some of my students there in that Sunday school class that were telling me about RUF. I remember the first thing I heard was that in RUF they loved this book, J.C. Ryle's Holiness, and I'd found that book in a used bookstore in college, and it really had been a huge impact on me, and I thought, any college ministry that likes J.C. Ryle, I want to know about this. So I remember going to visit, and I was struck by the fact that they were singing hymns, some traditional tune hymns. They were singing psalms, you know, some metrical psalms. Now, some of them to tunes that were a little hokey. We used to sing Psalm 19 to Annie's Song by John Denver. Some of you are old enough to remember that. So some of them weren't necessarily the best pairings. But they were trying to figure out how to be connected to the church's history and yet adapt to the situation they were in. They didn't have a piano. They had some guitars, maybe a djembe or some things like that. And I was struck by the fact that they were singing substantive songs, and Hal Farnsworth, the campus minister, preached a solid, real sermon. I'd always heard that college ministry, you had to kind of water things down. That had been sort of the conventional wisdom I'd always heard of. I thought I was kind of odd that I was maybe teaching people, you know, more solidly than that, but this was something that just blew me away. And already at that point, they were starting to do a few hymns to new music. A guy named Darwin Jordan, maybe some of you know, he's a pastor now in Fort Worth, but he had done a few. There was a little bit of this going already in RUF. So I ended up going off to seminary, and while that, you know, was kind of percolating, I came back in 1995 to Nashville. I was called to start an RUF at Belmont University. Belmont University is in Nashville, now it's about 6,000 or 7,000 students. Half the students are either music majors or music business majors. So it's a lot of kind of music stuff. And, you know, one of the things in RUF that we try to do is enter into the world of our students. So I found I had all these singer-songwriter students. I also was concerned that so many of the songs we were singing were undermining what we were trying to teach. I would have this regular conversation over coffee at a little place called Bongo Java, this coffee shop across from the campus. And I would talk to students, many of which were raised, who had been raised in the church. And they would talk about their struggles and their doubts. And they would have concluded that maybe they weren't really Christians. Now, maybe they weren't, you know. I think the doctrine of assurance is actually, you know, important but somewhat complicated sometimes to minister to people. And probably needs a bigger place in the seminary curriculum, honestly. You know, if there's one thing I would have added to my seminary education, it would have been more understanding of how to use the doctrine of assurance. But I was also convinced that so many of their kind of presuppositions were connected to the songs they were singing. In other words, they felt like if they didn't love Jesus and feel that love strongly all the time, that they maybe didn't have a right to believe that they were actually people of faith. And I would say things like, well, have you ever read the Psalms? Because what you're expressing is everywhere in the Psalms. And after sort of teasing this out, I realized they don't know the Psalms. All they know are the songs that they're singing, what are called kind of college worship songs, which are lying to them about the normal Christian life. Now, in RUF, one of our kind of core thing values that we operate out of is that T-D-O-E-E is always going on. This is what we call the discipleship process. You teach, demonstrate, students observe you, you observe them, you evaluate and encourage them. This is kind of how you take something. You don't just teach it, but you're also modeling whether you like it or not. And I realized the songs that we're singing are modeling something about the normal Christian life, whether we like it or not. So it was sort of out of this kind of budding movement that was going on, but also this concern I had as a pastor that the songs we were singing were lying to my students. There was no room for lament. There was no room for sort of psalms of disorientation or songs that reflected those kinds of things at all. We were just singing songs that were making my students feel like unless they loved Jesus intensely all the time, maybe they weren't even Christians. And here I was trying to teach them to depend upon the gospel, not their feelings. You know, as the Puritans like to talk about, they sometimes would call, you know, this experience of feeling the love of God, God's kisses. We don't despise God's kisses. We don't despise sweet frames. You know, that's that song on Christ the Solid Rock where we sing, I dare not trust the sweetest frame. Most people don't really know what they're singing, but a sweet frame is kind of an emotional state. It's a frame of spirit. We sometimes use that phrase, frame of mind, but it's more holistic than just your mind. That we would sing that, and yet, honestly, my students were trusting in sweet frames. And when they didn't have sweet frames, they wondered if they were Christians at all. And so it was just, I just had to find some other songs to sing. And I started looking in some of these old hymn books that I had. I'd basically in college didn't really have anybody disciple me. At some point I realized I needed to learn some things. I just started buying books, used books. Now, in the 80s in Boston, there were so many great used bookstores, but I was telling a guy last night, like, literally I would read one book and I would tell my little Bible study, you know, I don't think Paul wrote any of the letters that are attributed to him. And they'd be like, oh, I don't know if that's right. And then the next week I would have read B.B. Warfield and I'd be like, okay, I was wrong. I'm sorry. You know, and I don't recommend that. But for me, you read 500 books in a year, you kind of get to the point where you see more of a consensus and more of the things that are radical fringe. And sort of, but I'd always sort of had this thing like these old books have helped me more than these new books. And so I started looking at some of these old books and I remember finding some really important, some really great hymn texts that just were not in our modern hymnals that I just thought, man, we need to be singing stuff. Now, I hope that what we're seeing, you know, in the 20 years now since we've started doing this music, I hope we're seeing more of a coming together of pastors and worship leaders attending to the kinds of songs that we sing. And I do think I see that happening all over the place. One of the cool things is just to see so many young pastors and worship leaders caring and attending to what the songs we're singing are saying and the way they're shaping people. Because I need to tell you, worship is formative, like it or not. You are modeling something about what the normal Christian life feels like when people come into a worship service. And if you step back and think about what is the subtext, are you saying to people that if your life is falling apart, you have no right to be here unless you leave those sort of distractions at the door? It's a deeply unbiblical idea, but unfortunately all too prevalent. But I think some of those things are changing, and it's encouraging. You know, there's a long history of pastors caring about the songs that we sing. We tend to study Reformed history as a history of preachers. And I got to tell you, it was fascinating to me when I realized how much attention Luther paid to church music. He's got his famous intro to one of the hymn books, which only contained like 20 or 30 hymns, his first little hymn book, but he called on German poets to noise the gospel abroad. A Catholic cardinal living a century after Luther said that Luther damned more souls by his songs than with his teaching. Now, I don't think we would see it quite that way, but we would say that certainly the songs of the Reformation were very important. Calvin, you know, worked on that church music really his whole career. It was intensely important to him. When he showed up in Geneva, they hadn't been singing. They weren't singing. He writes to the city fathers. He tells them, our prayers are so cold and lifeless, we really should try singing. But they won't let him. And when he gets kicked out and goes to Strasbourg, that's when he first hears Bucer and his people singing psalms and hymns in German. And then he's even more convinced we've got to do that. He actually publishes the first Genevan Psalter while he's not in Geneva. And when the city fathers ask he and Farrell to come back, one of his conditions is only if we attempt singing. We've got to try it. And he continued to work on it. Did you know that George Whitefield published a hymnal? Most people don't know that. Most people think all he did was run around and preached. But he cared deeply about the songs people were singing and put together a little hymnal. J.C. Ryle put together a hymnal. All I knew about was his book Holiness and all these quotes from Puritan authors. And then I started reading Puritan authors. But he put together a hymnal. Spurgeon put together a hymnal. Philip Schaff put together a hymnal. I could go on and on and on. And I hope that we're going to see, and I pray and long that we'll see, a renewal of pastors attending to the songs that we sing. Because worship is formative, like it or not. And it's important to understand that it's one of the ways that God has said that the word of Christ will dwell in us richly. See, what does music do? Music tends to intensify whatever we're feeling or saying or singing. Augustine famously said that when you sing, you pray twice. Maybe it's apocryphal, but I think that sentiment is certainly in there. In other words, there's an intensification, whether it's lament or whether it's praise. There's something that happens when you sing. In particular, I was finding with my students, we needed songs that gave voice to lament, confusion, and songs that got the beauty of the gospel into our hearts. So I want to look at a song about lament that I found so helpful. This is Dear Refuge of My Weary Soul. You can jump down to the next slide. So I meant to bring this cool old hymnal. I found this old book. It's John Rippon's collection. John Rippon was a particular Baptist, English guy. He actually was a predecessor to the church that Spurgeon eventually took over. So before Spurgeon was a guy named John Gill, and then you go back a few pastors and you get to John Rippon. John Rippon is one of the very first Englishmen to include a hymn of human composure, not a psalm, but a hymn during their communion service. It got a lot of, you know, controversy, but he and a guy named Benjamin Keach were some of these early English Baptists that started doing this, even before Isaac Watts. And I found this collection, I think that one is 1804, 1806. I found this in a used bookstore, and I tell you, I was drawn to it because somebody had put another piece of leather, like glued over the spine of the book, because it was falling apart. And I thought, this is kind of cool. This thing was so loved and so worn out, and yet they decided they needed to keep it around. That must be a good book. That's all I thought when I bought it. And then when I started thinking, we need some new songs, and I don't know where I'm going to find them, this is one of the books that I opened up, and I just started reading through it. And as you'll see, I don't know if you can see with the sun, I can't see it very well, but I know what it says. It says, Dear Refuge of My Weary Soul, and just that name, Steele. I had no idea who Steele was. In these old hymnals, you know, prior to the Civil War, hymnals don't have the music in them. Back in these days, the church might know half a dozen tunes, and they would sing their entire hymn book to that. Because they only had a couple meters. You know, English hymns don't really work in that many meters, particularly back in this 18th century. And so, you know, just these words, and then the name Steele. And I thought, when I read that first line, Dear Refuge of My Weary Soul, I thought, this is surely not a song that would be on a contemporary Christian record in the 20th century. I'd been in that field. I'd been in that business. This is not the kind of song that would have gotten played on the radio, but this is exactly the kind of song I needed my students to sing. And I needed my students to know that Christians have felt this and thought that it was important to sing this in church. Now, this hymn hadn't been in a hymnal for a long, long time. These kinds of songs really dropped out. I don't know if it how, if it had much to do with the victorious Christian life movement, but you see a lot of these hymns of lament disappear in the early 20th century. So this hymn hadn't been in a hymnal for 100 years. But I thought, gosh, we've got to sing this. And so I started basically, like, sometimes I would just Xerox off the words and we'd sing it to a pre-existing tune. Like, you can, if you know Come Thou Fount, you know a tune for Come Thou Fount, you know a tune for Amazing Grace, and you know a tune for Rock of Ages, you can sing a lot of different hymns just with those three. But sometimes I would say to my Sunday school class, hey, somebody should come up with a tune for this. In this case, I came up with a tune and we started singing it. But I want to take you through the way Ann Steele works this out. Now, Ann was a particular Baptist, so she's a Reformed Baptist. That means she believed in particular atonement. Her father was the pastor of the Baptist church there in England, lived in the countryside, and she was somebody who suffered greatly. Now, there's some apocryphal stories about her, but she's just a fabulous hymn writer. She's the first female hymn writer of real significance, and up until Fanny Crosby, the most prolific Baptist hymn writer, and tremendously popular. Her hymns cross denominational lines quicker and more thoroughly than Watts or Charles Wesley. I think because she reflects the Psalms, and the English people were so used to singing Psalms that there's an easier easing into her songs, which seem to echo the Psalms as they take us through a journey. Now, this is a pretty typical song for her. The original title, God, the Only Refuge of the Troubled Soul. And what she often does is she'll start out with some creative name for God. It's not a biblical name. In other words, you won't find a verse that calls God the dear refuge of my weary soul, but it's eminently biblical, right? So she'll often start, much like Psalm 73, surely God is good to Israel, but let me tell you how I struggled and almost lost my grip. And then I finally kind of came back. I came into your presence in the holy place, in the temple, and I came back to sanity. That's what her hymns often do. She'll start off with an orthodox confession, and then she'll tell you how she struggles to believe what she just confessed, and then she comes back to a place of trust, but it's not giddy triumphalistic. It's sobered by the reality of the already and the not yet. Look at how she does this. Dear refuge of my weary soul, on thee when sorrows rise, on thee when waves of trouble roll, my fainting hope relies. I remember seeing that word, fainting hope. Is that okay to say in church? I thought we had to pretend that our hope was solid all the time. She's honest, and she says, you're the one on whom my fainting hope relies. And then verse 2, while hope revives, though pressed with fears, and I can say, my God, beneath thy feet I spread my cares and pour my woes abroad. She's saying, I'm having a moment of gospel sanity. I'm having a moment where assurance is comforting to me, but I'm still struggling. I'm still pressed with fears. But while I'm at a place of being able to say, Lord, I believe, help me in my unbelief, let me pour out my woes to you. So verse 3, to thee I tell each rising grief, for thou alone can heal. Thy word can bring a sweet relief. She's full of these wonderful adjectives, isn't she? For every pain I feel. It's good, good orthodox theology, but look at verse 4. But oh, and the exclamation point is hers. She published her own hymns, actually under a pen name, Theodosia. So it was a little, you know, progressive, to say the least, for a woman to publish hymns in the 18th century. So she published under a pen name, Theodosia. But the punctuation is how she put it. And she's full of exclamation points. She wants you to feel things deeply. She says, but oh, when gloomy doubts prevail. Isn't that an interesting choice of word? That's a bold word to use in a worship song. When gloomy doubts prevail, I fear to call thee mine. The springs of comfort seem to fail, and all my hopes decline. Yet, gracious God, where shall I flee? Thou art my only trust. And still my soul would cleave to thee, though prostrate in the dust. You see this, like, arguing back and forth. And how helpful is it to actually take that story on and sing it? Dan Allender said one time that if we sang more psalms, we'd have a whole lot less need of Christian counseling. I think that's true. And I think if you sang songs like this more, same thing. We wouldn't make people who are struggling labor under another level of difficulty in believing that Christians don't struggle. See? It's one thing to struggle. It's another thing to believe that you shouldn't struggle. Do you know that the suicide rates are worst in the most developed countries? Sweden, Finland, Denmark. And people speculate that it has not so much to do with their actual situation in life as the gap between their perception of what life should be like and what they're actually experiencing. And I think that happens in church all the time. That if people feel like these sorts of things never happen to Christians, then when it happens to them, they feel alone and they feel like they must be crazy. And they wonder if they're Christians at all. Don't do that to your people. Verse 6. Hast thou not bid me seek thy face? And shall I seek in vain? And can the ear of sovereign grace be deaf when I complain? She's owning this disorientation. Can the ear of sovereign grace be deaf? And you're like, no, but that's what she feels. But she's sort of taking the truth of what she knows and arguing with her soul. In a sense like, you know, why are you downcast, my soul? Let's spread it out on the table and talk about it and look at it and examine it in light of God's word. And then she comes back to this place in verse 7. No, still the ear of sovereign grace attends the mourner's prayer. Oh, may I ever find access to breathe my sorrows there. I love that line, breathe. It's not, okay, I'll tell you what I think. No, breathe means I can barely get the words out. I don't know if you've ever been in that place. I get more letters from people who've buried children to this hymn. There's something about being set free to sing a hymn like this. Verse 8, thy mercy seat is open still. Here let my soul retreat with humble hope. Attend thy will and wait beneath thy feet. She comes back to a place of trust, submission, but it's certainly been sobered and tempered by dealing honestly with what she's really feeling. You know how important it is to sing songs like this? I don't care if you sing this tune. You can sing this hymn to a lot of other tunes, but I want people singing these kinds of songs because worship is formative, like it or not. The other thing that I thought was so important in these early days and continues to be a conviction of mine that's so important is we need to get the beauty of the gospel on our hearts. And honestly, I will tell you, this used to just be anecdotally. There's just so little actual explication of what the cross is about in so many modern songs. Now, what used to be anecdotal, I actually know in a little more thorough way now. I actually had an opportunity a couple of years ago to be part of a week-long seminar at Calvin College and Seminary up in Grand Rapids, Michigan, a gathering of theologians, worship pastors, musicians, about 20 people, where we examined the top 250 songs, worship songs, used in the last 20 years. Because of CCLI, which is this organization you have to report what song, modern songs you use in your churches, you have to report to them. Because of that, we can keep pretty good data on what songs are actually being used in our churches. Now, to be fair, we don't know, you know, what words were used to introduce these songs, but we can know what songs were sung the most, okay? And then there's a guy, Stephen Marini, who's done a similar thing for hymns and looked at least in American hymnals, what are the top 250 most reprinted hymnals in the last couple centuries? And you can examine these two groups of songs. In our case, our particular challenge and job, the reason we were up there, was to examine these two sets of songs and then consider the issue of moral therapeutic deism and whether these songs might have something they've contributed to that. Moral therapeutic deism, Christian Smith, sociologist, says is basically the functional religion of most people in America. They basically believe that God is distant unless you kind of bring him close and worship, and asking him to come is one of the ways that we kind of bring him close. But the idea is that God just wants you to be happy and healthy, okay? Well, you know, it's interesting. In those top 250 modern worship songs, do you know that the word sin is not used as a verb one time? Not one time. There are a few references to sin as a noun, like forgive my sin, But there's never, Lord, I've sinned. Never. There's only one or two references that we would say are really, truly Trinitarian. Shine, Jesus, shine has a line, blaze, spirit, blaze. It's not very much Trinitarian development. It's a fleeting reference. Of course, there are hymns like Father, I love you, Spirit, I love you, Jesus, I love you. It's not really Trinitarian development. At least it's a reference. Now, I don't say this to say that all modern songs are bad, no. But I do say, like, the cross, when it's mentioned, is only mentioned. It's never developed. And I'm firmly convinced, you know, based on the Bible, that it's as we gaze upon the Lord's glory, Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians, that we're transformed from one degree of glory to another. And as Paul says elsewhere to the Corinthians, I determine to know nothing among you except Christ and him crucified. If we're not gazing upon God's glory revealed in Christ crucified, I think something's really lacking. And again, I don't think the songs have to bear all the freight of that. Though in an RUF meeting, we don't have the sacraments. I have songs, I have prayer, and I have scripture, preaching of the word. Right? I want to use the songs to get everything I can. Thomas Chalmers, great Presbyterian churchman, said one time that we need to use every method, every manner, everything we have at our disposal to get the beauty of Christ onto our heart. Well, arise, my soul, arise. We're going to sing this one here in a second, but we might jump to it here. Arise, my soul, arise is an amazing hymn. It's actually, I met a guy named Lester Ruth, and if you want to explore some of that kind of modern worship songs versus hymns, he's a research professor of worship at Duke and has done a number of scholarly papers and articles that are on his website there. You could explore this more if you want. It's kind of his constant sort of theme these days, is sort of examining these two groups of songs for different themes and different tendencies. But I remember when I first met him, he asked me, how did you Presbyterians find Arise, My Soul, Arise? He said, I consider it one of Wesley's best hymns, and yet the Methodists haven't sung it for 100 years. And I said, well, it's in the Trinity hymnal. The Presbyterians have held on to it. And we have. And it's actually a communion hymn. I don't think that's where it appears in the Trinity hymnal. I can't remember now. But it's a communion hymn. I didn't know it was a communion hymn, but I remember I was at a conference. There's this man, Jack Miller, who started Sonship and World Harvest. Now they've changed their name to Surge. And he had sort of wanted us to try to sing this hymn at the beginning of this meeting. And I thought, this captures so much of what this renewal movement, week-long seminar thing was about, but the tune just didn't seem to fit very well. So I put this tune, but I love the way this brings out what the cross is about. And I think that it's so important that for 2 or 3 minutes, we get to sit in this truth. We get to examine it. We get to view it through the eyes of faith in a way that is transformative. Arise, my soul, arise. Wesley says, shake off your guilty fears. The bleeding sacrifice in my behalf appears. Before the throne, my surety stands. Before the throne, my surety stands. My name is written on his hands. Good night. That's some pretty great soteriology in just like 5 or 6 lines. We need to sing songs that actually are getting into what the heart of our salvation is all about, not just making passing references to it. I think, you know, it was the other day, Christianity Today, I think it was yesterday, released an article about sort of surveying evangelicals and how their basic ideas about God and man are just not even things that the historic church would have considered orthodox. And again, we could stand singing some songs like Arise, My Soul, Arise.